First of all, thanks everyone for coming. I think it's time to get started. So this is the office panel, and I know it was billed as the office cage match, but we've discussed it, and what we really want to do is have an intelligent discussion about office leasing, lease terms, what are the key points, what's going on in your markets, and by the way, we want to make this interactive. So before we start, let's do some introductions. My name is Dave Ariola. I have a firm here called Chicago Realty Company. We do primarily office tenant representation and project management. And I'm going to let everyone on the panel introduce themselves.
Good afternoon. I'm Jim Hockman, proud to be an associate member of SIOR. I've been an instructor for SIOR for many, many years. I'm a partner at Arnstein and Lear here in Chicago with a real estate practice in commercial transactions, but more important, representing commercial real estate brokers and property managers. Nice to be here.
Thank you, Jim.
Hi, I'm Vicki Noonan. I'm with Tishman Speyer Properties. We are a global real estate developer operator of real estate. I've been with the Chicago office for over 30 years, and my entire role has been office leasing, representing the landlord.
So good afternoon, Harold Dempo. I'm a partner with the law firm, the Chicago law firm of Mutch Shellis. We're about 100 lawyers. We have an office in California. I'm co-chairman of the real estate group. We do a little of everything. And personally, I've done many office leases, retail leases, and all kinds of leases over the years.
Great. So it's a panel, but you know, we're all from Chicago. We know Chicago has their nuances. We have a lot of people here from other states and other markets, so we would love to make this interactive and hear, if we bring up a topic, what's going on, and other people benefit too, what's going on with lease terms all over the country. So again, thanks for coming, and I'll start us out. While we're preparing for this, we thought something interesting came up, the value of a letter of intent and how we use it to negotiate the lease. So I think we had some thoughts on that, and I'll throw it out. Anyone wants to start with that one? And how we use them.
Well, why we started with that is because I'm the landlord and I hate them. I find that what we're trying to do is put 10 pounds in a 3-pound sack. You've got three lines that's going to be a paragraph that ends up being 4 pages in a lease document, and I think it's an awful way to start a relationship.
And I'll echo that as the landlord's attorney. Just yesterday, negotiating a lease where the letter of intent never spoke to security deposit or guarantee, okay? And so we wrote a lease and we sent it out, and at security deposit we said to be discussed, and guarantee we said to be discussed, and they don't want to provide either one. So as she suggested, you know, it has a lot of problems. You could spend more time negotiating a letter of intent than the lease itself.
This afternoon, I'm the tenant's rep. I love them. I love them because a tenant probably has more leverage at the outset of the negotiation. You are, first of all, requesting a proposal and then moving into letters of intent, and you're trying very hard to qualify a transaction. Now, I think a well-written letter of intent goes so far and not farther.
Right.
Let's stick to the business terms. But as an attorney negotiating a transaction, if the other side begins to depart from the letter of intent, and this could be office, it could be industrial, it could be retail, doesn't matter, I will look at my counterpart and say, excuse me, but is the letter of intent dead? In which case, all terms are now up for grabs, or are we staying within the four corners of those basic terms on which our clients have reached agreement? So I use it for that purpose. Now, I will go on to say there are good letters of intent and not so good letters of intent. What do you folks think? Postprandial nap kicking in. Come on.
Good.
I think time kills all deals. And if we can get to a letter of intent reasonably quickly and then allow the attorneys and other parties to get involved in the lease, we save the deal.
I think that as a landlord's attorney, I want in the letter of intent that is not binding until such time as there's a lease has actually been executed. I think what a tenant wants is that it's off the market, okay, for a period of time while we negotiate everything, basically the contract, the lease, whatever it is. So I've done deals where the letter of intent has been 30 pages long.
Yeah.
That's a nightmare.
I should mention that Harold did the leasing at Sears Tower for a number of years, so probably seen a fair number of deals through a 4 million square foot building.
As a tenant, well, what do you folks think? Letter of intent, binding or non-binding? None. How many say binding? How many say both? Or am I alone on this one? Here's why it's both. Here's why it's both. Because as a tenant, I do want that space off the market for a brief period of time. And because I am relocating from another market and bringing a number of employees, most of whom don't know this is about to happen, I want a measure of confidentiality. So my letter of intent in our situation would have a non-binding section and a binding section, which would be what I call a standstill clause, space off the market for a period of time. You will neither seek nor respond to other offers. And our negotiations and the fact that my client, the tenant, is interested in the space remains confidential. And I'll respect the fact that you want a time frame on that.
Right.
Because time does kill all deals.
It's more like be careful what you wish for, because things come up and you can use that letter of intent against me and I could use it against you. For example, in the course of conversation, negotiation, you want the right to terminate, but it wasn't in the letter of intent. So I don't have to agree to that at all, because you missed it in the letter of intent stage. See what I mean?
Well, I think we have different expectations on the degree
that's a
of completeness.
Business term, though. Yeah. So it's a material business term. If it's not in the LOI, I, as a landlord, I'm not prepared to give it to you. Now, the terms and conditions of how you get there, if that's vague in there, that's a different story. But if it's there, it's there. If it's not, it's not. But I don't feel that way when it comes to security, which is interesting. Because I think in today's marketplace and in today's overall environment, security is still an important consideration. And I think tenants should really recognize that that's the case, as compared to thinking that it's, you know, the startup is credit is great.
Yes, sir.
On your standstill language, how would that run when you're inserting that into the letter of intent? When does it start and when does it stop?
Landlord agrees that for a period of time commencing upon the mutual execution of this letter of intent for X days thereafter, Landlord shall neither seek nor respond to any offers from any other party with respect to the subject space. Notice, that's pretty one-sided, isn't it? All right, now Harold will come back because I've negotiated with him and he will use every word and syllable that I've used and said, well, if that's fair for the landlord, he will say to me, I need a commitment from the tenant that you will focus your full attention on this building. Mm-hmm. And that's a great negotiation point. You just bilateral symmetry the thing to death.
And how many brokers go around town with a letter of intent? It could be unsigned and say, listen, you know, I'll negotiate with you if you could beat this, and including the landlord in the building that they already are in.
Brokers don't do that.
Which is a hard thing to do when it comes to the confidentiality, because everybody talks. Real estate is not a confidential environment by any stretch of the imagination, and everybody gets a wind here, or so-and-so's brother-in-law knows this, and so how do you get held to a confidentiality standard? It's in no one's best interest, clearly not in a landlord's best interest, to know, let the marketplace know that you're negotiating a lease for a space, so it's never in my best interest to tell anybody that, but somehow it's always out there.
I have done more leases with letters of intent that are never signed. They're given to me as a roadmap. Go ahead and draft the lease. And we just move forward.
Well, that's a great question, and I've been wanting to ask you folks that, because I can count on, I think, one hand the number of deals where I've seen the fully executed letter of intent,
right,
but I've seen at least one signature or broker signatures. How many of you typically take that letter of intent to the point where you have counter signatures? So we have two parties signing them.
That's who you deal with.
Yeah, okay. So maybe a half?
About half,
just
yeah.
Quick ballpark? Okay.
So, Vicki, I got a quick follow-up question. If you have a signed letter of intent without the language we were discussing, you're still showing that space, aren't you? You're treating it as if it's still perfectly available.
Depends.
She takes the
honestly,
fifth.
Depends on the
pleads
voter.
The fifth.
Yeah, it really does depend. If I have a high degree of confidence that the deal is going to get done, I'm not. And I've been in a negotiation right now, painfully, thank you, for almost a year. And that space is sitting there, and we're going to get it finally done. And the reason is because it's such a deal that is accretive to the value of the building, it is worth my time to do that. And we've been nudging and pushing, but yes. Now, other spaces, and we've had this, you know, full disclosure, you got three people looking at this space all at the same time, first to step up, you know.
It's 3,000 feet at the end of the hall, and I can take it or leave it, says the landlord. So step up, little tenant.
Well, it's not, yeah, you can say that too, but I would argue that if, first off, I started in the day where I shook your hand and said, we have a deal, and we started documenting. And I really liked those days because it kept us all really honest. Having said that, I get why there's more documentation needed, there's more corporate oversight, there's more a lot of everything. But I think what's ever fair to the transaction, if you've really been good faith working on it, is one thing. If you've gone away for 4 months, don't come back and tell me that, oh, I wanted that space.
So it's the Bob Dole test. Remember Bob Dole, boxers or briefs? Depends. All right? Depends. It depends upon the relative size and the leverage of the parties. I think we agree a little bit. And I think it depends also on the character of the parties with whom you're dealing.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps the brokers and how they are conducting the negotiation or the search. So now we're coming down to know your players.
Yeah, the letter of intent from the tenant broker perspective is always, you hope you don't miss anything that they think is, it's a fine line. How many terms do you negotiate in the letter of intent,
right,
versus how many do you think your client are going to think are really important, right, and you should have negotiated in the letter of intent? And, you know, one of the interesting ones that always comes up is security. Now, I always demand, security is a, it's a deal point. It's a business point.
Mm-hmm.
And what I see is the landlords or the brokers, for whatever reason, always want to push it off to the end. So then you negotiate a deal, and then they say, we want $300,000 security, you know, for the next 10 years, and your client freaks out. So I try to get it up front. Sometimes we get pushback from the landlords because they have to review financials, has to go through their system. But how generally, in your guys' experience, are you handling the security issue, which I think has changed, too. I think it's a much more serious issue than it has been in the past.
As a tenant, I'd love to push it and find out at the early stage when I have the most leverage what the requirement is going to be. And the landlords, in many cases, are very clever to defer that toward the end of the negotiation where all my other prospective deals have blended into the woodwork and they're gone. And now I am, if I may use the expression, in deal heat or deal pregnant, in the sense that I've committed to one building, my alternatives are gone, and now I find out that you want how many months of security?
I actually think that's wrong. I think you put it up there right up front, and the reason is because I don't want to waste my time if at the end of the day you're not prepared to give me what I need to move forward. I'm going to move on to the next guy. I'm not going to wait till the end and have negotiated and worked hard to get this whole thing, and then all of a sudden you say to me, forget it, I'm not doing it. I said, okay, fine, well, walk away.
Then we do agree, get it out there early.
It's all about underwriting the tenant, and when has that been finished? At the front end saves a lot of headache.
If the landlord's willing to do
right.
it. Yep, go ahead.
Little louder, please, for the group.
Yeah. There is a microphone, by the way.
If we could use the microphone over there, too, in the future.
Well,
but
go
the
ahead,
question,
Jack,
the,
shout
the,
it out.
The question was tenants don't want to give out their financials too early in the process.
The landlord will sign a confidentiality agreement up front, not to worry.
Sometimes that's not enough for a tenant, and they are worried. And so it's never in the initial proposal stage that they will come to me. If they've expressed an interest and they really want to, you know, pursue negotiations, is usually when I will get their financials, and I will sign a confi, and we'll figure out, based on that, what we're prepared to do. And sometimes it goes into several meetings talking to the CFOs, especially today. We've got a lot of startups and, you know, undercapitalized firms, but that they've got a good growth story and they're going where they're at. So it's really, you know, looking at what their overall history is and everything. And so it's usually not at the very beginning, but it's sort of in the middle.
So again, to this matter yesterday, the broker who may be in this room is laughing. Oh, it should be 1 month security deposit. It wasn't in, there's nothing in the letter of intent. We're owned by a publicly traded company. So the response was, who's the tenant? Who's signing the lease? We have to understand who's the tenant. And where, you know, where's the recourse? Do you want the parent to sign the lease or guarantee the lease? So we're waiting to get their financials.
Yeah, what I've done in the past too is I said, look, if I'll find out who the asset manager is for my tenant, and you could send it directly to them, bypass the brokers completely, and we'll sign the CA. But Gabriel.
Sure. Vicki, maybe you can mention a little bit about how a landlord looks at tenant financials, because I find that tenant brokers have a very different view of what tenant financials are and how strong they are compared to when we look at that as a credit analysis on the landlord side.
It's not really my big bailiwick, but I can tell you there's a couple of key points. So law firms, for sure. At the end of the day, when you're dispersing all your assets at the end of the day, that's, you know, we want to make sure that there's enough money there to pay the rent. And so we understand that. We understand the financials, but we're probably more likely to ask you for a letter of credit. And frankly, we're only doing letters of credit these days. The bankruptcy laws and the clawbacks and all the rest of it, we're only going with LCs. And so you have to be prepared to do that. Second thing is when you give me this wonderful balance sheet that's got hundreds of millions of dollars of revenues, and then you've got this goodwill number in there that says that's part of your, you know, value, it's like, okay, and then at the end of the day, that's the only thing that's making you profitable, that's a concern for me. And I think that ultimately, overall, we try and figure out what the business plan of some of these firms are and understand their growth cycles, and we'll do, they're always going to have to put up an LC, but then the burn down may be more aggressive depending on their revenues or less aggressive depending on where they're at. So I don't really, it's not my bailiwick per se, but.
How many months rent does your letter of credit usually represent?
Generally, I would say it's, in this market, Chicago, it's 30 to 40% of the out-of-pocket costs, which can be a year or more, or, you know, any place in between. And it's really, the concessions are what drive it for me, not so much the months of rent. Landlord's out-of-pocket, inclusive of my commission to the in-house, outside, rent abatement, TI, termination fee, if anything, yada, yada. So sometimes they're pretty significant.
And I've done many leases where that will burn down over time.
I just finished a small law firm deal, and they picked the building they're at because they had the lowest security requirement, period. So over the term of the lease, it wasn't the best economically, but they... There were three partners, and they didn't want to come up with $100,000 a piece to sit there for, you know, a year and a half, 2 years.
Go ahead, Jim. Go ahead.
I was going to ask a question. What do you folks say? How do you describe the tenant whom you represent? Who is your tenant? Is this a strong tenant? How do you respond? Because I'm sure that comes up early on.
I didn't hear it. They're always strong. Is that the answer?
They're always strong until they're not.
Yeah, exactly.
They're strong until they're not.
Right.
This isn't about war stories and litigation, but I found myself defending a counterclaim in a commission suit because my broker had described the tenant as a national credit tenant. I never really understood that term, national credit tenant. But, of course, by the time the lawsuit was filed, the landlord viewed a national credit tenant as a strong credit tenant.
I would. I mean, just realistically, it sounds like.
Is Filene's basement a national credit tenant?
It used to be.
Up until their bankruptcy.
Right, exactly.
Up until it wasn't.
Yeah. Until it wasn't. You know, the other thing in this market, I don't know about other markets, but definitely in Chicago, we are known for robbing Peter to pay Paul. So we are going forward. Right now, we are doing leases that expire in 2020. and you're trying to negotiate them to either relocate to new construction or renegotiate them to stay in your building. And, you know, so we're robbing Peter to pay Paul. And right now, we are in a very much of a luxury situation. For the first time in a long time, we're getting a lot of inbound business from the suburban market, not necessarily the best thing for us, some new tenants coming to the market, but also moving things around. So there's a lot of tenant terminations, which are fueling some of these, especially workplace strategies. It's changed everybody. So 10 years ago, they did Y, and they had all these private offices, and now they want this open benching. So termination fees are a big thing. And what we're seeing a lot of is that the tenants are asking us to pay their termination fees before they ever occupy. And that's where the letter of credit is extremely important.
So just to clarify, who are you paying the termination fee to?
I pay it to the tenant. I do not pay it to the landlord.
For the other lease that they're moving out of.
That they're moving out of. And so the day I send that, before that, I have the letter of credit for the full value and then some. Because at the end of the day, some of these, as I said, are not going to be effective until 2020. So I'm hanging out there. I'm not getting any rent from anybody. I'm not doing anything. That's a big thing. And some of the tenants aren't so happy about it. Well, I'll just pay it then. I'm like, okay, well, then pay it. And I'll reimburse you when you're my tenant. So
that scenario also assumes that they have a termination option in their lease, which is something that tenants should negotiate for. Right, Jim?
Yes.
I don't like
and
that.
You should mention the right to terminate that will be so important, I think, in the RFP.
Right.
Yeah.
So that it is in the letter of intent. And again, a quick example was that very large lease with a 10-year lease, and my Canadian company came back and said the CFO wants a right to terminate at the end of the third year, initial term 10 years. And the landlord was the Teamsters pension fund. And we were about ready to have the final conference call on the few remaining lease issues. And I was about to introduce for the first time an option to terminate to the Teamsters pension fund. I called landlord's attorney and I said, my client has a significant business term to insert. If you're going to re-underwrite this transaction, it won't shock me. But I want you to know about it in advance. I want you to discuss it with your client in advance so that when we get together, there are no surprises.
I agree.
Great move, right? We joined that conference call, and guess what didn't occur? Landlord's attorney had not talked to landlord about our request for a termination fee.
That's foolish.
And the Teamsters Pension Fund taught me words that I had not heard in my first 20 years in the Navy. So that underscores this option to terminate.
Was it in the letter of intent?
Of course not.
Yeah, I
that's
think
just
with,
so
the other side of termination is the termination fee or penalty.
Okay.
And, you know, most of the time it says, or you, at least from the tenant broker side, you leave it, you could leave it somewhere, and it says, you know, unamortized costs. Well, what does that mean? And you don't think about it until it actually comes time to calculate it, and then you need to go back and figure out what the landlord's costs were five years ago.
Well, a well-drawn lease, we'll talk about what those unamortized costs are.
I think it's important that the lease be specific what those costs are. The brokers, the TI, the free rent, all that gets amortized as you go along, and when you pay the fee, it's the unamortized, discounted to the present value. And plus something on top of it.
Right. I actually think it's a really good idea because we buy and sell buildings and we assume leases and we get that very language and have no idea, per se, exactly what the value of anything was. And so I think, and what we've been doing because of that is, after the transaction, after the tenant's in, and if there was any speculative, you know, dollars of what would be valued, we actually come up with an example, and it becomes an exhibit to the lease, because at the end of the day, if they expand or they contract, you've got a methodology to get there, because then you're going to be in an argument. There's a law firm in town that was literally in a huge argument over what the calculation was, so much so that at the end of the day, rather than go litigate, they've figured out a way to renew in place. But they were in court for almost 8 months arguing what the heck the termination fee payment calculation was. It's just not worth it. First off, at the end of the day, we're a global operator. I'm going to see you again. You might be leaving me today, but tomorrow's another day. So I really don't need to have you pissed off at us as a landlord. Besides, you could be my tenant in New York or in India. It just doesn't matter. So to be upfront and have everybody have no surprises right. is just a much better way to go about even putting up those fees.
I also recommend on the landlord side, when you draft these provisions to rights to expand, rights to terminate, time is of the essence. Meaning, if you blow the date, you lose the right. And you negotiate that into the document. And it's, in my opinion, I treat that as a material provision. Because 5 years later, when that tenant blows the date, okay, I can tell a judge, if I have to, that that was a material component to the negotiation of the lease.
I have a question. Who has ever had a tenant exercise an option to the letter of the lease?
One.
Two.
No, there's a couple.
Okay.
We spend so much time negotiating all that stuff, and I've never had an experience where anyone's ever exercised it to the letter of anything.
If I have an option to renew at $22 a foot, that's great. That's a starting point of a negotiation.
And it's below market, let's say. You know. But again, it's all about leverage. We're talking about negotiation. If it's in the lease and, like you say, most people call up the other side, let's talk about this termination. Would you give me a calculation? Go look at the lease and see what it says. You know, the lease has been in a drawer for 5 years, and it said you have to notify the landlord not less than 13 months before the lease expires, and you're in the ninth month. You have leverage now over your tenant.
There's a best practice here. What happens after the lease is negotiated and done, and what happens when the tenant occupies, and we now have some critical dates, so we know when the term starts, and we have some critical dates when an option must be exercised, whether renew, expand, or terminate. And you have, again, when the parties are still in love, this is early on in the landlord-tenant relationship, now you've got that addendum to the lease, which sets these dates, and I've learned something today, and sets the costs.
Right.
Yep.
Okay, now you have something to talk about when you sell the building.
Agreed.
With certainty, and even the tenant has the certainty that it wants. Are we still on letters of intent?
I think we moved on. But something else did come up, and that's one of the things that bothers me and my clients is the relocation, right, to relocate them. And that always seems to come up 12th hour, and it takes many different forms. Sometimes it's a one-time right. Sometimes they can do it as many times as they want. And it's very hard to explain to your tenant who just designed their dream space that, you know, they could move you tomorrow if they wanted to, and they'll give you new stationery. So how often are you seeing that, and how are you handling it?
Again, it's all relative. The smaller tenant, the landlord's not going to take it out most likely. Larger tenant, I think the landlord will be more willing to delete that from the lease. How it works, it's usually pretty basic, generic, that the landlord can notify the tenant that he's relocating the tenant within the building. You can negotiate as a tenant, and Jim can certainly describe how we would negotiate that, but we as a landlord will relocate you at our costs. So the tenant should not have any out-of-pocket costs. You might even agree to not materially interfere with your business, so after hours, on the weekends, etc. Okay? Then the tenant may have all other kinds of requirements or requests, the right to terminate the lease, but you know, I wait to hear from the tenant, and 90% of the time, it goes right through it. No one even looks at it.
I guess I'm that other 10%.
That's why you're here.
I want, representing a tenant, I would seek to limit the relocation, perhaps to once, perhaps under certain circumstances. Mr. Landlord, Ms. Landlord, why do you need to relocate me? And I might hear something such as, well, we have one or two substantial tenants who are likely to expand, right, and we want to keep those tenants in the building. And I will say, fine, you may relocate my tenant if one or the other of those two substantial tenants need the space, but only in that circumstance.
Right.
Now we've limited the scope of the relocation.
And I will get stuck there, because when that big tenant moves and all of a sudden now I have 40,000-foot floor and your 2,000-square-foot guy is there and I have a tenant that wants 40, I want to be able to move you.
And when we start to talk about how size matters, I find myself when representing a smaller tenant and I hear about we're a big building and you're a small tenant, I sometimes have to say, perhaps my tenant needs to look at a smaller building with a landlord who will give more consideration to its tenancy. And I might hear back, you're absolutely right.
No.
Hit the road, Jack. Or you'll say, no, no, not at all. We care.
Right, exactly.
If so, you good. Well, if you care, then let's...
Right.
Yeah, there's things that we can do that. But I think to... First off, it's not cheap to move anybody. It's a lot of money. So you're not going to exercise your right to move anybody for the sake of a small transaction or something that isn't significant for valuation for the long term. So it's a lot of money. So you're not entering into that in a willy-nilly fashion in the first place. And yes, there's no question that there are conditions and things that we'd be more than happy to agree to because I understand that you just negotiated for the suite of your life.
So you have a question.
In my opinion, and for the record, I've exercised a right to relocate a tenant in the last 60 days. And unfortunately, this is a very large tenant. This is a 22,000 square foot tenant, which means that this is a very large transaction that requires that. So at landlord's cost, what I had budgeted and what I anticipate I will have to spend is all the costs to relocate the tenant, cable, physical, stationary, phones, switches, all the rest of it, all the hard construction costs associated with that, stationary, some other things, permitting, yada, yada, yada. What they have come back to me with in the most recent time is the time that the employee has to review the drawings, to sign off on, go to a project meeting, so forth and so on. And there's one other thing they asked me for the other day, and I was like, no. So.
And let's add some loss of productivity, because now you're ripping my favorite four walls out from under me to relocate
me walls
at your whim, and my business will shut down for at least 2 days in the best of moves to pack and to unpack.
Well, I have to do that. I'm packing you and unpacking
and
you.
On the weekend.
And I'm doing it after hours.
On the weekend.
And over a weekend.
Okay,
and
so
then you show up on a Monday morning or a Tuesday morning.
So my employees will not lift a pencil.
Nope. They don't have
and
to.
And they will leave at 5 o'clock on Friday, everything intact.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And you will move.
Except I will ask you to organize your desk and put it away so that I don't have to worry about losing something.
So I've had tenants negotiate the same view that they are facing north in a high-rise building. They will only be relocated above the 40th floor, that they will not pay more rent. They will not pay more pro rata share if the space is measured larger than what they have today. Okay, you know? Okay, so they got that. Because we want to make them happy.
That's Michael Boyd, are you in this room? It's a big room. I can't see everybody. You probably know I teach with Michael, and he talks about this particular provision because his firm has been relocated a couple of times in his office building in Houston. The landlord had the right to relocate them once. And after the first relocation, when the landlord came back again, Michael had some leverage and was able to negotiate mm-hmm. some changes in the lease, which worked to right. the firm's advantage, the tenant's
correct.
Advantage.
Right.
So there are things to be gained here.
Yep.
What about
yeah.
Yeah, all of that. All of that.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
The bottom
as
line
I said,
is
it's expensive.
You're
I mean,
being,
this 22,000 square foot tenant has very generic space,
right.
lots of furniture systems, very few walls, and the whole all-in cost of this right now is close to $104 a foot. So it's not an insignificant cost for me to do this, but it's worth it in the scheme of things for what I'm doing. But that's why I say this is not exactly like I'm going about this willy-nilly.
Right.
Great. Okay, so let's move on to another topic. We discussed operating expenses a little bit, caps, controllable expenses. I always have to argue about capital expenditures and all that good stuff. Where do you see us, Harold, now on those issues?
Well, we're in a room filled with people from around the country, so I'm sure everyone is seeing something a little bit different. Right now, I'm seeing rent over a base year with expenses not to exceed, well, increases not to exceed 3% a year, roughly, excluding out the non-controllable costs, and then you define non-controllable costs, what those are.
Okay, I actually think that's not the norm, though. I think the norm is just you pay your pass-throughs,
okay,
and then the cap comes in on larger transactions, not on smaller transactions. Okay.
A little point. Define what is controllable, or what are controllable expenses and what are not.
Well,
because I've seen that squabble a little bit about what are the so-called non-controllable expenses in our market and in your market.
Well, we do it in reverse. We say everything but the following, right, non-controllable are controllable. So
right,
the non-controllable that have no caps would be utilities, insurance, snow plowing, wages, and maybe government regulation, expenses related to complying with government regulation.
Maybe I'll just ask a shorter question.
Well, taxes aren't even part of common area expenses. So yes, they're not even in my definition.
Correct.
Of CAM.
Maybe you give me a shorter list then.
I've seen
the controllable ones.
Controllable is everything but those, so, you know. And that's capped in our discussion right now.
Also, management fees, I'm pushing those in. They're capped already at
okay,
a number, therefore they are, quote, what they are. You're not going to tell me that because it went up 4% this
right,
one year because I rented space, that's
right,
going to be the difference.
Well, then you have this whole exclusion from CAM, right, which could be a page long if you use me as your lawyer. I mean, I give, an exclusion list like this to the landlord, that none of these items are included in CAM. And you know what the usual suspects are, with respect to negotiating a lease, enforcing a lease, the mortgage debt service. Those are the common ones, but you can get into, things like salaries above the level of the manager, and you can get artwork excluded and health club excluded. You can get things excluded from CAM that the next guy doesn't even touch that section.
I too would like to carve out a number of things from CAM, but I often encounter, maybe you do too, maybe Vicki, you want to answer this one, when the landlord comes back and says, I'm not going to redo all of my accounting for this building
right,
because you've got a special list.
Right, that's a problem.
I would say
that
90% of the time, there is no special list. There are a few tenants, and you have a different cost pool for those tenants. And you know what? Accounting's accounting. The deal's more important.
The 300,000 square foot tenant is different than the 3,000 square
absolutely foot. And the 3,000 square foot tenant isn't going to get the separate cost pool. They're just not.
Right.
I don't care
right,
if they're Amazon
right,
and they're only taking 3,000 square feet. It's just not going to happen.
Right.
I hear that all the time.
Right.
Yeah. But capital expenditures, I don't argue that. I mean, because if capital is defined as, capital in accordance with GAAP, it is what it is. And so I don't ever get into a situation of trying to figure out what capital is included in operating and what's not if you use that definition.
Amortized over what period of time?
Useful life.
As determined by?
Independent whatever.
An independent whatever. See, exactly. I want an independent whatever.
Yeah.
I don't want in the opinion of landlord's
right,
accountant, landlord's brother-in-law.
It's not
night school.
And the more aggressive landlord will say the lesser of 3 years or useful life, something like that, to recapture that quicker.
And Vicki, probably every building you have is a net lease
yes.
building versus modified gross, which
right. So everybody benefits, you know, and our taxes, you know, are billed 1 year in arrears here. So we are aggressive on our tax bill, you know, our contesting. So far our tenants are happy. And because of the size of our portfolio, we have 9 million square feet in this market alone. We bulk buy a lot of things and therefore are able to pass on those savings. And so we try and keep our T&O pretty competitive.
Sir.
Yes, sir.
Question.
Legal question relative to the exception for latent defects. And a firm discussion that I had a few days ago relative to latent defects being less applicable on a 25-year-old building than they are on a new construction building. Your thoughts? I'd be interested to hear.
I'm not sure I understood the question.
Latent defects?
Whether that's an exclusion from the operating expenses.
Okay. Go ahead, Harold.
Does the age of the building matter relative to that exclusion? I say no, but what do you say?
I say yes.
I would agree, yes.
Because I think latent is by its nature is that it wasn't available to be discovered. And after 25 years, I think you've discovered just about every wart that building's got.
But you haven't owned, you may not have owned that building for 25 years. You may have bought it 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm. It's not a latent defect by that time.
It should
it's
have been corrected
defect.
By
it's
the 25th year.
What latent would be, the legal definition would be?
I defer to you guys as to the actual.
Not something that's not readily discoverable.
Discover within a certain period of time, or
I've never seen it qualified.
At the time of signing that lease, it's not known. It's not known. If it was known, it would be discussed in the lease, most likely.
Yeah.
Or it could not have been discovered with a reasonable inspection of
right.
the property.
So one more question, a little bit off this topic, relative to
that
a default provision. To a default provision,
mm-hmm.
okay? For the first time, I saw a lease document and a landlord stand firm, 6,000-foot office lease back to 500,000-square-foot building, 6,000 feet my customer was looking for. One of the default provisions was a clawback on tenant improvements.
Yes.
So it's customary in my market that the clawback has, for the past 5 years, has been on lease concessions. Never seen tenant improvements. And I was just curious if anybody else has seen that.
I've seen it. It's not a landlord I readily embrace, but I've seen it. Sure.
I haven't done that.
I haven't seen it, but it's a great idea.
I may tomorrow. You never know. But what we've now started to do is, in a condemnation or a casualty situation, tenants are insuring all of their leasehold improvements, and we are actually, it's part of our standard document these days, that we will receive your insurance proceeds up to the level of value that I gave you for those improvement tenant improvement allowances.
That's that's
FYI.
A provision the attorneys always like to negotiate, and frankly, I hate that. They put me to sleep. When they talk about condemning a building downtown Chicago, you probably have bigger issues to deal with.
Well, I hate that a tenant says to me, if you take 2 feet from me, you're effectively
condemning.
We're
talking
like,
about
that? Really?
Well,
really?
No, we're not talking about it.
The use of the property, taking a certain amount of square footage in front of a retail operation
that's
may be
very
significant.
Different. Yeah, right.
Okay?
Right.
No, on the 15th floor of an office building.
Agree with you. Now, the thing about, and we're curious here on your experience, but when I represent tenants and I start to tear apart or try to tear apart the landlord's remedies in the event of tenant default, that sends a signal to the other side of the table.
It's a sin.
Well, I prefer other sins, but I caution my tenants that you send a signal if you worry too much about being in
right.
default. Yes,
right.
sir.
No, the exact comment from the institutional property owner leasing representative, who I know very well, also said that if your customer Tom pays the rent,
sure.
you don't have to worry about it.
Of course.
It. Except for the asinine request, that not only do you get to call back a base
what's the likelihood you're going to collect any of that?
Really?
Right.
And I said, irrespective, it doesn't matter. That's the only reason this is such an asinine position that Mr. Tennant, I don't think under any circumstances you want to agree with.
Yeah, we could pick any, I mean, really, you could pick any clause you want and make a big deal out of it. And it never continues to surprise me which ones are made a big deal of in the lease negotiation.
I negotiated on behalf of a landlord leasing several floors of a South Loop office building to a local university, which occupies space in several buildings in the South Loop. And we were talking about late payments of rent, and we were at the once a year you may be late without penalties, but second time will incur penalties, right, and third time you will lose your option to extend. And I got the huge pushback of we can't afford to lose our option to extend or our option to expand or whatever. I said, well, pay your rent on time. Well, we're a large university. We occupy suites all over the city. And what if our bookkeeper is sick?
Wire transfer the money.
Bingo. I said to her, and I know we're switching hats here a little bit, but I said, if you're not on auto pay for all your leasehold obligations, Ms. General Counsel, you should start now because that will satisfy my client who needs this assurance. And oddly enough, they went to auto pay. So we kept the remedy.
Right.
But it comes up.
Mm-hmm. Another one that comes up often is self-help. So, and you know, I think we've all had our share of landlords who, at least I always get tenants all the time say, hey, my landlord, hate the way that you run the building, and you know, we have to have this on the next deal because we don't want to pay for it. But I've never seen it. I've never been able to get it, really asked for it, but have you seen any movement on any of this?
Self-help, every tenant asks for it. If the landlord's not performing its obligations, the landlord, as you said, Dave, says, it's my real estate, my operation, I can't have you operating my building. Okay. Well, what if it's a life safety situation or if it's an emergency? There's a roof leak and we need you to come out immediately. So in any other circumstance, we say, give us notice and we'll come out within a certain period of time. If we don't, we're in default. If you do it, we owe you the money, okay? Life safety, the fire suppression system is not working. The alarm system is not working. We must have it repaired immediately. Okay, give us 24 hours notice. If it's not done, then you can do it. Self-help. Not unreasonable. It's
how often
practical.
Do you actually get it,
it's a practical situation. We talked about the document, the legal stuff versus reality. You got to operate your business, and if you're dealing with HIPAA laws or whatever, you have to maintain confidentiality. You have to make sure the doors are locked, and you know you need to take care of business. And the landlord, you know, is nowhere to be found for some reason.
I think I would use a similar argument in the default provision and say, Mr. or Ms. Landlord, if you're going to do everything you need to do, you should have no objection to self-help after notice and an opportunity to cure.
Again, it could be in your space, and it's got to be only an emergency, and only if it's not, it's after notice, et cetera, et cetera. That's self-help, only within your space.
Well, what about common space where I'd be denied access? Landlords, you gotta let me finish the question before you say no.
On the telephone, he wouldn't see me, you know, shaking my head no, but since we're here.
Real quick on self-help, are you typically asking for the tenant to be reimbursed for costs plus time, plus? Or what are you asking for the reimbursement of the self-help?
Actual out-of-pockets.
And for the most part, and again, I work in an environment of high-rise office, nobody wants the self-help to go fix my chiller. Nobody wants the self-help to go fix the elevators when the elevator doesn't work and, you know, that kinds of thing. And so if for self-help, First off, to have it arise to the level that it gets to be so bad, something catastrophic has happened, and 90% of the time, nobody wants to spend the money for it. So I think, you know, you negotiate the self-help and you make sure it's right and all the rest of it. But again, in all my years, I've never seen anybody exercise it.
But what goes part and parcel with self-help is the right of set-off, right?
Yeah.
So now I owe you the money and I don't pay it to you within an X period of days. You want the right to deduct it from the rent. That's a big problem from the landlord side.
You know, this is all fine and dandy while we have a solvent landlord operating
Correct.
A building which is largely occupied. Another part of my practice deals with receiverships. So now you have a landlord who is no longer in possession or is losing the property to the lender, and it's in that phase before the receiver comes in where no work is being done.
Right.
Now that self-help becomes critical.
Right. Contact the lender. Abandonment?
Going dark is what you're saying.
He's asking if an office tenant should be penalized for going dark in their space, and should it even be in the lease, or I guess they should have the right to go dark if they want.
Right. Vicki, how do you feel about that?
And we generally say as long as you're paying the rent, you're not deemed abandoned. And that clause is not really in our leases anymore because for the very reason, we would, you know, if it's not going to matter, it's not going to matter.
And my experience is recently we just take it out if they ask us to take it out.
In fact, landlord might even want to recapture the space under the circumstances.
You never know.
I have had suburban landlords insist that the tenant could not have a go dark provision based on the visibility of the office space and how the vacancy would impact the image of the building. Mm. So I got pushback. I feel your pain, in other words.
But retail for sure, that's just a different animal all by itself.
Well, you read my mind. That's the next topic. But go ahead, ask your question. Start us off.
As a general matter, in Chicago, it's $5 per year lease term, generally. Having said that, it's dependent on the building and the rent and, you know, all that, all those things. But generally, the consensus here, for the most part, is that you're going to give the tenant an improvement allowance that at least builds their space to a medium level, nothing crazy. They want, you know, stone tile on the reception, that's probably on them. You know, on full height glass everywhere is probably above and beyond. But that's generally what's happening.
Is that a shell or second generation?
Either one. We're still a market that gives that kind of cash for renewals as well as raw space. It just goes farther in a renewal. It would range anywhere from, I would say, 18 net to 35 net, depending on the asset. And our T&O generally is about 16 and a half.
I know on the tenant side, we've been getting, well, the deals I've done recently anyway, the tenants are really pushing back and they want the landlord to deliver everything turnkey because they don't want any construction risk. So I'd say probably the last 8 deals I did have been turnkey. Actually, that's more the rule now than the exception.
We also have a big market of spec suites being built these days. So we're building speculatively suites for tenants to move in with the conference and the kitchen and offices and yada, yada, yada. And on that general basis, because we're doing them in large quantities, they're costing us anywhere from $50 to $60 a foot. And so we won't do a term for those suites that's anything less than 7 years. Pardon me? Various sizes. The smallest ones we probably got are close to 2,500, and the largest one we just did was 25,000. And at least before it was done. Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Right of first refusal to lease and right of first refusal to buy, to purchase?
Rent adjacent space.
Right.
I don't like them.
I could have told you that.
Right of first refusal, I think, goes too far. I think it's really difficult for me as a landlord to go out to the marketplace, and if you were the prospect to negotiate the letter of intent or to get it finally done, and then I still have to go to the guy next door, I am more inclined and to give you a right of first offer, and it would be caveated that I am in negotiations with someone that it looks promising, and I'll come to you then, because I don't want to go down the path and have done all the homework and then you pull it from me, and nor does the tenant want to be, you know, in that situation.
So are you saying you would more readily give a right of first offer?
I do. I more readily give a right of first offer with the caveat that it won't come just because you're sitting there. It will come when we have a serious prospect.
Are you familiar with the phrase ice in the winter? A right of first offer is indeed ice in the winter. You're going to come to me anyway if there's vacant space adjacent to my tenant space.
Sometimes, yes.
So that's really you're giving me something you would have done anyway. I need protection that if I'm going to lose that space and you're willing to make a deal with someone else, I want the right to take that space. Now, if we can figure out a way to determine a deal point that triggers that right of first refusal that's workable for you. Signed letter of intent?
See, I don't want to go there. That means I've negotiated fully with someone that wants this space, and now I have to put them on ice, to use your term, for as long as the other tenant decides to come back to me.
I'll go with a short fuse. That ice won't melt. We'll go 5 days to take it or leave it.
Mm-hmm. I still think that it's not in everybody's best interest to go that far. I think you can set up a ROFO such that if, in fact, I gave you terms that are material different or there's some percentage difference, then I have to come back to you. But beyond that, you know,
right. We're
all big boys and girls.
The last two tenant deals I did, they had ROFOs on the adjacent space.
Right.
The landlord didn't give him any notice of anything.
That's a different problem.
That's a problem.
Yeah, no, I know, which I found interesting.
That's a stick.
And I said, well, really, what's our real recourse when that happens?
It usually is silent.
It's not in the lease, so what do you do?
What the recourse is?
Well, it's a breach. You can't cure it.
Ask for forgiveness.
We moved.
There is no Rachmanis clause in this lease.
Okay. Well, that's a problem.
Yeah, and
I... Because you're in a technical default, and so you'll...
But it's a technical default you can't cure.
You can't cure it.
Okay. He who first breaches a contract cannot then enforce it.
What's
right?
What's your tenant going to do?
Leave.
I don't know that's the available remedy. You know, maybe I'll agree to offer you something else in the future. I've
never seen it go there, but yeah. This is an interesting theoretical discussion because, frankly, it's not just that I'm making the argument, but I think it's a good one.
I think it's
more than a technical breach. If I had a right of first offer and the adjacent space was material, and who knows who that next adjacent tenant is.
Right.
And you can't cure that default, so it becomes a breach. I think now I'm in a position where I can terminate the lease.
But it's mind-boggling that the landlord would screw that up because of what Dave or someone said. Your first prospect is the guy next door. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
I think they assume they would have heard something, or they assume they discussed it, but they never gave them notice that it was available.
And say, okay, how do we solve this? What is it that you really need? Let's figure this out. And then in this instance, you have more leverage because clearly I've blown it, but notwithstanding it, you're trying to work it all out. Yeah. My goal, and my tenants hear this all the time, the best lease is the lease that sits in your drawer and you never have to read it. Because that means you've got a good tenant relationship going on and that you can work openly and honestly about issues all the way on both sides of the equation.
I think that comes with a period of tenancy mm-hmm. and trust, and you work to earn it on both sides.
Correct.
But in the lease negotiation, you right. don't have that.
Right.
I agree. And we spend so much time doing all sorts of this.
Back to Mr. Podolsky's question, a right of first offer to purchase the building, or right of first refusal to purchase the building. So you're a single tenant in a single tenant building, okay? it's certainly not unusual to try to negotiate that up front, okay, because you're the most likely candidate, again, to buy the building. Walgreens has them all the time. Right, so you can exclude that, you know, out of your lease, that unless it's sold as part of a package. But, you know, if I'm the single tenant in a building, office or industrial, I think it's important for that tenant to negotiate that up front and get it into their lease. It controls, you know, their future, their destiny.
And we have done that with single tenant buildings in California and in Atlanta, for example. But all of our buildings here are multi-tenanted and million plus, so it really never comes up in my world. It's a right of first offer before you go to market.
Have any of you noticed a right of first refusal in an antenna lease in an office building? You better read those puppies closely. I had a client selling a building, and we were down to the last few issues on a signed contract to sell a building, I guess an eight-figure deal, and someone discovered a right of first refusal in an antenna lease.
To buy the building?
To buy the building.
That's interesting.
Wow. Whoops.
Somebody dozed through that, not on my watch, fortunately. Fortunately, the antenna user didn't want it, but they wanted to protect their right to keep that lease there, and they had negotiated a right of first refusal, and nobody caught it. Yes, sir.
That's a fun discussion to have with your tenant client to say the same space you have is now bigger and you have to pay for it.
Or smaller.
Or your pro rata share is going up.
Rarely does it ever go down.
Right.
Yeah. I haven't seen that one.
We've done it all the time when we go back to leases. There are certain leases, depending on the sophistication of the tenant, that has protected themselves with regard to that for renewals or whatever. And then I say to myself, but you have an exercise to the four corners of your document, therefore. But generally what we've been doing is there's no question there's a change in market and it increases. And sometimes you'll spread out a little bit more of concession, you'll phase the square footage in over time. It's all a negotiation because at the end of the day, for the value of the building, you definitely want to have your building be at the highest rentable area you can. And so how you get there is open to discussion.
So the remeasurement in your question comes up, if I understand correctly, where a tenant is going to exercise an option to renew, and suddenly the space is remeasured and it's larger.
Or a new owner comes in. Yeah, and when we buy buildings, it's really important because, you know, we've got a building right now that we just remeasured for the first time. Arguably, we should have done it years ago. We didn't, and we've increased the square footage of this asset by 80,000 feet. That's a lot of square footage that you don't want to leave on the table. So, yeah.
So, question for the panel. You've been at this for a while, going back and forth. What's the general tone of negotiations you see now? Is it easier, tougher? Are landlords or tenants more sophisticated and asking for things you haven't seen? What do you see as a general tone? Vicki, you see a big mixture.
I don't think it's really changed all that much, to tell you the truth. It's market dynamics are making it a little different. Right now, there are large blocks of space are dwindling. We have one tenant that has been bumped from three buildings in this market because they didn't move fast enough. That makes them very anxious to make a deal quickly, and they'll sit down and get it done. And so I think it's market dynamics more than anything. I think from my perspective, I've always been fair. I've always, regardless, I mean, I really have been. I don't necessarily, it's not an idea of screwing one side or the other. You want to be reasonable. You want to get things done. I think that smaller tenants have moved away from asking for the 25-page LOI and, you know, all the rights of self-help, this and whatever. I think they've been counseled well to say, okay, let's be reasonable. What's important here? So I think right now, I think it's becoming a little bit of a tenant's market or a landlord's market here, which in Chicago, the landlord market lasts about a nanosecond. So we're very excited about that, frankly.
The tenants don't know that yet, by the way, at least mine don't.
Well, after the crash, I think it's obvious it became a very favorable tenant market for many years. And as now companies have started to expand and it's become more of a landlord's market because there's less vacant space, and at least in the CBD down here, okay? With the new buildings being built and the large law firms moving around, you're gonna then open up more vacant space. It's gonna tip the scale back to maybe more of a tenant market. We gotta lease up that vacant space.
I'm not sure.
In a Class B building, right. Class C building.
I'm not sure, actually, I would say that, you know, unfortunately, I'm losing two of my anchor tenants to the new construction that gets delivered in 2017. I'm gonna get back close to 700,000 feet, and today I've already leased three of it.
Okay.
So I actually think that there's a lot of really good activity coming into the market and moving, and I think that I'm not sure we're going to see the same dynamic of tenant demand, you know, being in a catbird seat in 17 because the supply quotient is so much less than it's ever been. So.
I think there, if I may add an observation though, that market dynamics change, leverage changes.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So your style of negotiation in a lease where you are facilitating what I call a multi-year business marriage ought to be such that when an issue arises which maybe wasn't covered in the lease or wasn't covered clearly, there's enough goodwill that there's a spirit of cooperation to work it out. And what I typically tell my clients, be they landlord or tenant, there's going to be something you want from the other side at a certain point that you may need badly, to which you may not be clearly entitled. And the strength of the relationship is what will carry you through and carry both parties to a reasonable resolution.
That sounds very reasonable. All right, so we've heard a lot of terms. We'd like to hear, we're talking from Chicago because that's our experience. Is there anyone out there from different markets that have terms maybe that are quirky or we haven't seen? Yes.
Yes, because the wherewithal of the tenant has changed. And honestly, depending on the tenant, most of our tenants have an annual obligation to provide us with financial statements so that we can continue to monitor them going forward. I mean, a publicly traded company is very different, and usually it says, you know, to the extent you're publicly traded, you don't have to, and it's my fault if I don't pay attention. But we have a lot of privately held companies, and therefore they do. We see their financials initially and then on an annual basis and definitely before we enter into a renewal with them.
Do you have to chase that down?
Generally, no. You just have to remind them.
I pay attention to what sort of financials are required and at what interval. If you work with smaller tenants, you may find that they can't produce an audited financial statement. You might be able to get tax returns. Mm-hmm. You might get the financial statement from the CFO or from the outside accountant. But when you raise the level to audited, there's a cost a small tenant may not expect. So the devil can sometimes be in the details.
Well,
things change.
Well,
General
Well,
Motors.
It's not a matter of rent, but more than likely I'm probably giving you some cash and giving you some abatement. And so the question is the financial wherewithal of your tenant today able to support that? And that's really what the question's about. It's not, you're never arguing about the payment history unless you have one. And so it's really more about the concessions going forward and the costs of the transaction, just like it was when you moved in the first time. If there aren't any, I would probably be less likely to be worried about it. And you know, if there aren't any. But if there are, I'm going to say it. But you know, there are certain lenders, candidly, that require it as part of a transaction or a certain size transaction. And so the tenant should not be insulted. It's not about that. And I also think it's the how it's delivered as well. I mean, you know, that messaging is part of it.
Vicki, do you ever look at the space to determine how well it's being maintained by a tenant?
Yes.
In that judgment?
Yes. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
So generally what we've been doing in this market, Tishman Speyer, I can't tell you what others are doing, but we're getting 30 to 40% of the out-of-pocket costs of a transaction and a letter of credit, and that includes the abatement. It is a big number.
It's a very shocking number.
And then if in fact you don't have the wherewithal, then we have to start thinking about it. And then what we do is sometimes the abatement's not up front, the abatement's later after rent has been paid. Or reimbursements happen this way or that way. We'll try and be creative, but at the end of the day, it's still a big
I've done law firm leases where we've gotten personal guarantees by the partners.
When I first start with a client, that's the first thing I tell them. I said, before we look at anything, call your bank. And because a lot of the times the bank will say, if you need a $100,000 letter of credit, put $100,000 in the bank and we'll charge you at one point to let it sit there. And they're always surprised by that.
Correct.
It's a big issue.
And that's why we asked for the personal guarantee, by the way.
Which I had a law firm with a personal guarantee. I really don't enjoy going after somebody's house.
No, it's not
a good idea.
Don't default.
Yes. Yes. It depends. So if, in fact, they put it all up and there's abatement for the first 12 months, it won't burn down till I've gotten a year of rent. So year two, it'll start to come down. And then in some instances, it can burn down. On a 15-year lease, generally, it will probably be gone by the ninth year. On a 10-year lease, probably stays up close to the full term because it's just a higher dollar value.
Comment on going after someone's house.
Yeah.
If you have a mom-and-pop tenant, and either mom or pop is operating the business, but not both, I always want, this as a landlord, I always want the spouse signing the personal guarantee.
Right.
Because, hate to say it, if it comes down to it, I do want their house.
I know.
Or I want the threat of getting their house. But again, that's in case I was a big, bad landlord.
There's a question out there. Right.
And the determination of prevailing market rate, that
right.
sort of thing. It kind of relates back to the LOI question. You know, I think being a tenant advocate, you want to get as much as you can in the LOI. You just think that if you're going to have a 5-year renewal at prevailing market rate for 6 months' notice, then you need a lease document. That's
right.
Like, yeah, and I decide what the prevailing market rate is, and you put a line in the road. You know, so how do you?
Well, as a tenant certainly wants certainty, and an option to renew at market is not a whole lot of warm and fuzzy for the tenant. So I may want a fixed rent, or I may want it to be a multiple of existing
right.
rent. So we've got bumps. There may be a third party index, or there may even be a mechanism by which landlord and tenant come to a reconciliation or a conclusion on what prevailing market rent is. And Vicky's dying to ask the question, and when's the last time any of you saw it go down the road that far, where the parties couldn't either agree or agree to disagree?
Just put a mediation or arbitration provision in there, and it'll force the two to agree and not go to mediation or arbitration.
But one thing I do want on a tenant's behalf is, if we can't agree, if I exercise my option to renew and we can't agree on what that rent will be, I want the right to withdraw my exercise.
That's fair.
And, fair.
And, that's fair.
And wave at you as I'm going down the road.
Exactly. Fair.
So, Steve, did you?
Go ahead. Go ahead. We'll add that to our lease, but usually it's a broker or, you know, with 5 years of experience or something like that.
What we've also seen as of late is, I tell you what I think, you tell me what you think, and if we're within 5 or 10%, split the baby and move on. And
works.
Everybody wins, I think.
That's very, very reasonable.
You know, I think it is. The other thing is that in the downturn, what was the other thing that it was important for us as we went into renewals was, I don't want to be obligated to fund TI. I want the arbitration and the mechanism of renewal to be based on the concessions I've offered. So whether or not that was a $15 net rent because I gave you nothing, or was a $25 net rent because I gave you something, it's a market transaction based on the concessions that were given, because in some instances, you know, cash flow was really king and there was value that had eroded and you didn't want to be obligated to have to fund things. And so that's the mechanism that you then determined what the, you were only determining the rent.
I mean, I had a lease at Willis Tower that actually identified other buildings in the Central Business District to use in determining an average fair market rent.
If you can get that information, I'm curious, how do you get that
from
information?
The property manager at the time or the leasing agent?
You get the listed rate anyway. I mean,
so well, I mean, always... I've seen very, very creative methodology, okay, but on the simplest form, you just say the landlord will tell you what it is, take it or leave it. And if you want to withdraw your exercise, withdraw your exercise. It's kind of what Vicky's saying. This is what these are the terms I'm doing leases at today. And you can't impose something else on me that I don't want to do.
Yes, sir.
The beauty of baseball arbitration, as I understand, are you all familiar with the term? One side gives a number, the other side gives a number, and when the arbitrator comes back, whoever's number was closest to the arbitrator's number wins, and you go to that number. I think typically baseball arbitration is there to discourage going all the way down the road.
And that's why I said, just put the provision in the lease, you'll never get there.
Go ahead. I felt there was a follow-up there or a fact story. Did you experience a baseball arbitration for a renewal?
We've been using it for like the last 5 years quite, you know, effectively, because it doesn't look that you need to negotiate that. Everyone knows the market's 25, but the landlord's going to come in at 29, and the tenant's going to come in at 21. But with that third-party determinant hanging over everyone's head, if they know it's 25, it's going to come fairly close.
So
have you ever gone to arbitration? Have you ever?
Yes, one deal.
One deal, okay.
One deal in how many years, right?
Right.
Right.
Agreed.
Right.
I think it's there to make everybody feel that you have to be fair. It's a mechanism, correct. But I do, and I push back on this a lot because I get this from tenants that say, after arbitration, I still want the right to revoke. And the answer is no. If I'm going to get stuck, you're going to get stuck.
Your lawyer already gave me that one.
I saw a crazy situation recently where there was no time deadline on the right to audit operating expenses. And a tenant hired an accounting firm, and they went back like 10 years. And they realized that the real estate tax calculation was wrong. And they came back to the landlord for $2 million. Okay? So when you're negotiating a lease, if you're the landlord, you learn from your mistakes. Thank goodness I never did that lease. You have to have a cutoff if you're the landlord on the time period the tenant has the right to audit the books. We're talking about going back 10 years. Are you kidding?
What's really frightening is let's suppose your client owned the building for 6, but somehow finds itself responsible for
10.
All right, we're getting close. Any other, we got time for a few more questions, so please.
Testing. I've got a deal where the landlord underbilled my client like $80,000 over, I think, 2 years. What's realistic in your opinion as far as how that should be handled and paid back and timing? They're being pretty cool about it, the landlord. Mm-hmm. They haven't really said anything specific, but what's realistic?
Landlord underbilled on operating expenses?
No, on rent.
On rent?
Yeah.
Underbilled. The landlord underbilled.
Underbilled $80,000 over probably 2.5 years.
And then they sent the tenant a bill for $80,000.
No, they just said, "Hey, we're short $80,000. It was our fault. Our accounting system, didn't bill you right."
And it's
accurate. Yeah. It's like $2,000 a month here and there. You know.
I'd
work it out.
Yeah.
I'd work it out.
Probably be a certain, depending upon the nature of the relationship and the tenant's desire to stay. For $80,000, excuse me, I might be asserting the doctrine of accord and satisfaction. We have an agreement. You're going to pay me, you're going to charge me $5,000 a month rent, but you've invoiced me for $4,000, and I paid you $4,000.
And you accepted it.
That's
the concept. So he's saying the tenant is telling the landlord, "Sorry, Charlie."
Yeah. Okay.
And I'm saying to you, as Mr. Tenant, by the way, your lease says $5,000. You knew you were not paying me correctly. Obviously, you didn't read. So therefore, you're trying to defraud me. I'm suggesting that you should.
I love you, dear, but I'm paying your invoices.
My invoice isn't necessarily what you're contractually obligated to pay.
Then read the lease before you send the invoice.
I think we should go to baseball arbitration.
All right. Thanks.
That's crazy.
Well, it's Texas. That's Texas.
That always explains everything.
Actually, your fact scenario is not all that out of line. Typically, I did encounter that once. It happened to be in Florida, and a property management firm who was doing the invoicing had to make good on the error.
Oh, sure.
It was a third-party property manager.
And they have insurance for that. See?
Yeah.
That's an interesting thought.
Yeah.
We have a very unique landlord remedy in the state of Pennsylvania. I don't think there are more than 2 or 3 states in the country that have it. And it's
called, do I want it?
It's called, you absolutely
public hanging.
Okay, good.
It would become your best friend. It's called confession of judgment.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if I'd be curious to hear. And by the way, this comes up in every single office lease.
Seriously. Well, we see
big
it
tenant,
sometime.
Small tenant. I'd be curious to the Sorry. Comments from the attorney.
Tell us what it is first. Early.
Well, you basically can get a judgment against, in your case, the tenant without serving the tenant with papers. You can walk into court and get a judgment. You've confessed judgment in advance of any kind of legal proceeding. Okay, here in Chicago, 90% of the leases I've never seen it in 100% of the leases I've ever done around the country, but you sometimes will see it in a promissory note. It's enforceable, but I've never seen it in a lease that I've done.
And the tenant remedy, just to support that, is typically, if I'm not going to fight the landlord on its remedies for tenant default, I am at least am going to require judicial process.
Right.
So that would kind of ease out the confession of judgment.
That's a crazy thing. Where
who, Pennsylvania?
Who did? Who said that, by the way? Where are you? Oh, wow. And tenants, if you ask the landlord to take it out, will they?
Yeah.
Yeah, and one for rent.
Right. Right.
Great. We have time for one more question. Go ahead.
Hi. My case is opposite of what what this guy was saying. In Mumbai, in India, we did a lease renegotiation for a U.S. firm. We got the landlord to pay all the taxes and the CAM charges and everything. It turned out for the last 3 years, they kept billing the tenants, and the tenants kept paying the taxes. And we renewed the lease again. We renegotiated again, got them a significant saving again. When I went through the lease with them, and they're like, we're already paying these. So for the last 3 years, they've already paid the taxes and the CAM charges. How do you resolve this particular thing?
Is this a right to audit question?
What happened is that he's been overbilled. So rather than being underbilled, he's been overbilled, and his client has paid. So your argument as Mr. Landlord, so you don't have to pay him back?
No, as Mr. Tenant, I have the right to audit because in this case, I am paying the CAM based on your landlord's statement to me of what the CAM is. I don't have firsthand knowledge.
No, you weren't supposed to pay it. Your lease says you're not supposed to pay it.
It's a gross lease. It's a gross lease.
It's a gross lease.
It's a gross lease.
They were charged a net.
You're not supposed to pay.
And you're right. It's called the voluntary payment doctrine.
Yeah.
And the tenant has a problem. Yeah. That's sort of the corollary to.
Exactly. It's the opposite. All I'm saying is everybody should be reasonable. They knew what the contract said, and so we should figure it out. I have no idea what will happen, however.
Vicki thought she was going to impeach me on that one.
I did. Yeah.
All right, I want to be sensitive to the time.
I have a question for what's going on with holdover in anyone's market? Is, consequential or direct damages becoming some, trying to get it out of leases, or is it still pretty much standard operating procedure if you're in holdover at some point, direct damages, consequential work? Yeah. Okay, just curious.
In my experience, that's the big issue. You can do the dance about landlord asks for 200% holdover rent, and the tenant counters at 125, mm-hmm. and they always agree at 150, mm-hmm. and then, or I just call that the dance, or you can get a little more sophisticated and give a lower holdover rent for the first month or two, but then step it up if the tenant has not gotten out of the space. But the big enchilada is the consequential damages, because when the landlord loses that next lease, that's significant.
And my theory on this, and these guys will tell me whether I'm right, is my direct damages, if I've lost the benefit of my bargain, all the rest of it, that is not consequential. That is direct damages, and that is what we should be able to collect.
If you had a letter of intent or a signed lease and they can't move in because this other guy...
Well, if the tenant ultimately, because I'm non-delivery in most instances, if you can't deliver it, they have the right to walk away at some point. I've lost the benefit of the bargain because of your holdover.
Vicki, this is one of those things where I'm saying to my tenant, you can't argue, you can't negotiate from your position of your default.
Right.
You've got a plan to get out when your lease is over.
How about a clause from the landlord's perspective that if you hold over greater than 30 or 60 days, that I have a right to renew you for 1 year at 150%?
Right. Well, we'll have to hold that thought. I need to stay on time for everybody, so I appreciate the comments. Let's have a hand for our panel.